titling this one, A Gentle Wilderness Inside Us. I just want to try to recap a little bit what we talked about last night, since it was a fairly intense and somewhat obscure even to me. I wanted to say a little bit about how modern the concept of religion is. The idea that there are many paths to discovering an ultimate reality. I said that really it's a new concept because most people who encounter God in one way or another claim that that is the ultimate reality. It's not a religion, but rather it is the way. Randy was talking last night about Tao means the way, the one way. So people in the past have not talked about, well, are you a Methodist or a Buddhist? They've said, have you taken Jesus Christ as your personal Lord and Savior? I mean, the difference between that. When you talk about religion, you're sort of saying that there's possibilities of many ways. I also talked about how primitive people have an integrated sense of the presence of God or the Great Spirit or whatever they tend to call it. And it's integrated with their living, so that how they hoe the fields and how they live in their families is part and parcel of their worship of God. Everything is in one holy, integrated whole. And how also modern is our concept of wilderness as a benevolent and beautiful, valuable spiritual place, rather than a threat or simply a kind of economic resource, that's a whole new idea as well. And then we looked at how we got to this point in history in relation to views of the land, the wrong turns which our traditions and our culture has taken, the false Judeo-Christian views of the land, that we are to conquer and subdue the land, rather than this emerging consensus that even in the Bible, the land was a gift from God, which shows the richness of God's love. And we also talked about the new thinking of God's relationship to us as God leading us on a promising journey to a new place, a fertile place, contrasted to the spirituality of ascent, where you go up to God by abandoning our bodily, temporal, physical reality, that somehow we have to transcend who we are physically in order to approach the glory of God. And then finally we looked at this graph and played around with that a little bit, talked about how we as modern secular people have sort of moved away from a deep, living deeply in nature with a sense of our bodies and biology. Essential, you know, people can very easily smoke 2 packs of cigarettes a day for 40 years and die of emphysema, which is something that's probably totally incomprehensible to primitive people who would be much more in touch with their bodies than we are. To a culture and tradition-centered kind of thing which results in Jewish times and a God of history and justice, in modern times it results in Nazism and on the bad side, and on the good side it results in what we're talking about, this new creation-centered spirituality. But fewer and fewer people actually adhere or find direction from their cultures. Many people simply respond to the pressure of their peer group and what is happening around them, which is the society as the center, the here and now of people and events and news and whatnot. And I said that, in fact, one of the crises of today is that some people don't even have a sense of belonging to their society. Like in Philadelphia, where I live, people are moving out of the city because there's too much crime. They don't see the poverty of the black neighborhoods is somehow a part of their life. They see it as something which threatens them and they want to get out of it. Self is becoming the center. If something is threatening, instead of digging in and trying to do something about it, people are retreating because it's just too overwhelming. So that is an interesting dilemma and problem. We talked about some of the reasons why this solution to the modern problem is attractive, this idea of freedom, immediacy, control, a high degree of action. There's a lot of talk, and also the power of science in which you separate things to know them. All of those things are attractions to making an isolated self the center of the world. But at the end of the session last night, we talked about how there's a promise that we can move away from the self-centeredness through the mediation of society, culture, and nature to approach a profound experience of God's otherness, God's the other, or God. And I would say wilderness is in the same category. We keep bouncing the word wilderness around, and Christine pointed this out last night, that Jackie had used the term wilderness as the wilderness of community, or the wilderness of my own struggle, or the wilderness of just about anything. And the way I'm using wilderness up here, I suppose, is partly in that way, but also wilderness as that which is kind of nature beyond, or an aspect of nature which is totally ineffable, though I can experience it through my senses, somehow I cannot command it or control it, whereas the wilderness of my own self, or the wilderness of community, I really can work on a little bit more than this idea of wildernesses as the one which comes to meet me out of its own grace, almost the same way that we talk about God coming to meet us out of God's own ineffable grace. I guess what I'm trying to say, and I hope I left you with this feeling last night, is that it's a very hopeful time. There's some new movements in theology, and there's a recognition of the danger of self-centeredness, so that we have some wonderful material to work with at this time, even in this community of people this weekend, to come to some new understandings and realizations, and perhaps through experiences of God's presence, a new sense of what we are. Who we are when we go back to the lives that we have left to come here. That in a sense, some of the breakdown that has happened might be a good thing, because finally we are after two millennia of exploiting and using nature to our own advantage in a sort of frightened way. We're realizing that we can't do that anymore. And Dick's going to talk a little bit later this morning about the ways in which the wilderness movement and the ecology movement has developed in the United States. But it has developed in a, not so much from the people of faith saying, this is a gift of God to us and we as people of faith need to preserve and care for this, but it's developed out of a sort of a political dimension, or just an ecological dimension of deciding that we need to spare some of these resources from overuse. But I'm preempting Dick. He's much more insightful on this than I am. So I don't want to talk too much about that. But I do want to say that this is a wonderful time to be alive and to be struggling with these issues of wilderness and the experience of God. And I'd like to look at someone who is an Old Testament figure who is at that kind of a time in his life, a story from one of the Old Testament prophets, someone who is totally caught in himself, disappointed, frightened, and wants to die, and how God, how the wilderness and God evoke a kind of new spirit within that person. It's Elijah, of course, and the passage that I want to read is in 1 Kings chapter 19. It's 1 Kings 19, which is on page 313 if you have the Bible that many of us have. Yeah, there's a few other Bibles up here if anybody needs them. What we're going to see is that this self-centeredness is not just a modern phenomenon. It happens all through history. Does everybody who needs a Bible have a Bible? We can maybe share. Okay. I'd like someone to read chapter 19 from verse 1 to verse 12.
Okay. Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he had slain all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah, saying, "So may the gods do to me and more also, if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by this time tomorrow." Then he was afraid, and he arose and went for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree. And he asked that he might die, saying, "It is enough now, O Lord, to take away my life, for I am no better than my fathers." And he lay down and slept under a broom tree. And behold, an angel touched him and said to him, "Arise and eat." And he looked, and behold, there was at his head a cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water. And he ate and drank and lay down again. And the angel of the Lord came again a second time and touched him and said, "Arise and eat, else the journey will be too great for you." And he arose and ate and drank and went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the mount of God. And there he came to a cave and lodged there. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He said, "I have been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, thrown down thine altars, and slain thy prophet with the sword. And I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away." And he said, "Go forth and stand upon the mount before the Lord." And behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind rent the mountains and broke in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a still small voice.
Great. And good. Who remembers the context for this story? What was going on that Jezebel was so hot to get Elijah?
They had a big contest with the prophets of Baal and Elijah, who was going to burn the sacrifice.
Right. Uh-huh. And Elijah ended up killing her 450 prophets. Just kind of a bloody mess, I suppose. But but Jezebel was not defeated at all. She says, "I'm going to get you. I'm going to make your life like one of these, namely one of the 450 dead prophets of Baal, by tomorrow morning." And so Elijah heads for the hills. So what's Elijah feeling at the beginning of the thing? What's your sense of it? I mean, it doesn't say exactly, but what's the context?
Fear, despair.
Fear? For his life, sure. Despair in what sense?
Well, he's just made this big stand, and now it seems like it's all gone against him, and now he's running for his life. Still, he's the only one left, and he's stood for God and deserted.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Isn't it, what's ironic about that? I mean, he's feeling despair, but who's he talking to? He's talking to God. It's kind of funny, I mean. It's not like he's saying, "I don't have a sense of God's power, God's presence." He's saying, "Yeah, I have a sense of God's power and God's presence, but nevertheless, she's about to kill me, and I want to die." It's a very difficult psychological and spiritual state that he finds himself in. What do you think? Is he angry at God, or alienated from God, or what do you think's going on there?
I think there's a real alienation because he's just gone through this whole thing where he's shown God's power and then the rain comes. I mean, everything that proves that God is there, and yet it falls apart.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the whole country and the king and the queen still say, mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of that. So basically, he's done everything he can do to convince, to show God's power to the people, and they just haven't changed. That's interesting. What kinds of things do you notice about his relationship to the wilderness here?
I was thinking there'd be some familiarity because he went to the tree and sat up the tree and was comfortable and
mm-hmm.
went to sleep.
Mm-hmm. So he kind of knows where he is. He leaves his servant behind for some reason. He wants to be alone, I guess. So the wilderness isn't hostile for him. It's a place he knows.
He's being provided with his food.
It's almost as if he goes into the wilderness knowing it a little bit, but the wilderness suddenly becomes fertile for him or something. Because he doesn't starve to death and he doesn't die, but God comes through an angel and takes care of him. What kinds of resonances do you hear in this passage from other parts of the Bible? What kinds of, what does it remind you of? What are the kinds of journeys or events?
Moses on the mountain.
Of course, Moses on the mountain experiencing God. What else? 40 days and 40 nights reminds us. Jesus in the wilderness. What's the other occurrence of 40?
40 years, yeah.
40 years? Is that, it rains 40 days, right. Well, that's interesting. I mean, the flood is a kind of desert, even though it's wet. I mean, it devastates. There are 40 years in the wilderness. What happens in the wilderness in terms of the harshness of the wilderness toward
manna.
The people? Pardon?
Manna.
Exactly. Miraculous food. So there's that resonance of miraculous food coming to someone who is... who sort of trusts God's leading, and goes to the place where God takes them.
And the earth opens up and swallows people. Well, 40 days.
That happens here?
No, not here. But you're talking. I thought you were talking about in man in the wilderness.
No. What I'm talking about are resonances that happened before in the history of Israel that are brought forth here again. The feeding, the miraculous feeding, the being in the wilderness, the 40 days, the mountain, just like Moses. I think that's it. I'm not sure. Came up with a couple I didn't even think of. Now, what I want to draw your attention to is what's happening here with the... This is a very marvelous passage, I think, because he starts out being very self-preoccupied, very... closed in on his own disappointment and despair. Things happen to him which draw him out of that. First, this angel feeds him. That doesn't quite do it. The angel has to come again, feed him again, resonances of miraculous food in the wilderness, and then give him a call. Says, eat or else this isn't going to be, you're not going to be strong enough for the journey that's ahead of you. And then he goes to Horeb, which is Mount Sinai, the mountain of God. He's gradually being drawn out of himself. But if you notice, it's not just any old experiences. It's not like, they're not any experiences to draw this man out of depression or despair. These are experiences that are very paradigmatic or very powerfully... present in his tradition already. These are things that would appear to Elijah, they would immediately begin to make sense to him and begin to remind him of what has gone before. This is a very important piece of coming out of self-centeredness, that you need to be drawn out into a bigger world, basically. And the bigger, wider world here is the world, interestingly, of Scripture. I mean, Elijah is reminded of miraculous food in the wilderness, reminded of the mountain of God, reminded how God revealed God's self to Moses, reminded of the 40 years of the desert journey, and it's saying something to him about his own life. What's it saying to him? What's the sense that if that would happen to you, what would be the sense that you would get?
That your work isn't done. That you're being called, more than called, you're pretty much being swept along. Right? Mm-hmm. You're not being allowed to sit under the tree and just say, this is how, what I would like is to have it all be over. My job be over.
But these things have resonances for him. I mean, God doesn't say, what I want you to do is dig a hole and plant a tree and come back and marry a wife. And, you know, God says these things, God does things that have happened before in very powerful contexts for the people of Israel in the history of their deliverance. See what I mean? And what I'm suggesting is that somehow these experiences for him are mediations of, they take him away from his self-centeredness through mediations to a sense of God, because these mediations are familiar to him. They're ones that have happened before in the history of Israel. They're not new things. We were talking last night about standards of experiences of God, whether there are standards of adequacy, some way that you can tell whether an experience is of God. Clearly, for Elijah, these are standards of adequacy. I mean, these are things that he's familiar with. These are things, miracles that are not brand new, but miracles which tie him to something which has gone before, which remind him, first off, the food that comes to him is a sort of biological reminder that God cares for the people. And then the call to traverse the desert, the number 40 and all of that stuff, is a reminder of his cultural tradition, how the people of Israel were saved from Egypt by God. And he knows what to expect when he goes up the mountain. He knows what to look for. It's not an entirely new thing. He knows what probably, what God does on top of mountains. Though we didn't read that far, at the end of this experience, there's also a social kind of mediation, because God says to him, go back to your culture, go back to your society, and tell them what to do. So in a way, Elijah, who is stuck over here in himself as a center, is given food, given these reminders of his tradition, and given a call to go back to a society. And all of those things put him in touch, bring him out of himself, and put him in touch with God's purpose for him. So the problem of self-consciousness and self-centeredness, his persecution complex, his despair, is resolved through this mediation, through recognizable experiences, things that were not new for him. They were new to him, he experienced them, but they had resonances in the tradition. They had resonances which were very, very deep. Now, that brings me back to this discussion that we had last night about standards, and I thought it was a fruitful discussion, and I'd like to kick it around some more today. As you recall, at first we were talking about standards as if to discredit somebody else's religious experience, to say, well, I know what a religious experience is, and you didn't have one because I know what it is. And that's not the role that I want to focus on primarily, though I do want to remind you that the church, in the history of our tradition, has always exercised this prerogative. For example, if someone came along and said that she had a revelation from Jesus, that Jesus said to her, I never was truly human at all, and that all you need to do is to remain celibate in order to attain perfection. Now, someone comes along and says, I've just had that revelation from Jesus. The church would say to that person that the revelation isn't, and not in keeping with the gospels that we've received and our tradition. And so we'd say, the church would say, it doesn't measure up to our standards of adequacy, that Jesus was human. And that if somebody has a revelation that Jesus says, I am not human, and that you have to transcend your humanity in order to attain God, we'd say, it doesn't measure up. Now, that's interesting, but I don't think we want to be doing that this weekend. I don't think we are about that business, using standards of adequacy to exclude visions, but rather I think we want to use standards of adequacy to, in a mediating function, that is, to keep ourselves open, to expand our consciousness about the possibilities, how God has appeared to people in the past and shown them God's way. To get more opinions and keep conversations going, both with living people, as we're doing here, and also with the tradition, those who have gone before through scripture and learning and whatnot. I read a book called Religious Experience by a guy named Wayne Proudfoot in preparation for the retreat. And it helped me to think more clearly about the issues at hand, talking about meeting God or having a revelation from God, what it means to have religious experience, what are the standards, how can we talk about that? I don't know, this meeting God in the wilderness, you realize that through most of history, people have talked about that in terms of revelation from God. Joseph Smith would have talked about a revelation from God in which the angel Moroni, I believe it was, showed him the place to dig, and I think he dug and found the Book of Mormon on tablets and wrote them down, and then the tablets disappeared, a revelation from God. We call it meeting God in the wilderness, and I think it feels a little bit more comfortable to us because meeting God in the wilderness doesn't suggest this big, profound idea of an earth-shattering second coming of Christ or a new revelation. But in essence, they're the same thing, and the reason that I bring that up is because I think the way we were talking last night is that meeting God in the wilderness is a personal affair between me and God, and it doesn't have anything to do with the rest of us. You know, it's just whatever I feel about God. But in fact, this is the stuff of, if indeed God does speak to us, meeting God in the wilderness is, or meeting God in any sense, is stuff for the whole community. If you have a revelation of God and you don't tell me, that's a shame. You know what I mean? If you meet God out there and the rest of us don't, but you keep it to yourself, I think God would be disappointed. If that's how God does come to us, and I believe God does. So I'm saying that these are, it's very important for us to keep our talk going and to be saying what our own past experiences are, and perhaps if we have present experiences this weekend, and to mediate them and to think about what standards we would use personally and perhaps corporately to discern if an experience is of God. Some of the other things that I learned from this book by Proudfoot are that when one thing is that when people talk about encounters with God, their language changes. I think that's important. I think we'll find that. I think your when we talk together, I notice that your language changes when you talk about a profound experience. My language definitely does change. People who talk about religious experiences tend to avoid relativizing language. As I suggested last night, religious or religion is a relativizing word. It suggests that there are many ways to get to God instead of keeping the focus on God and God's power as it comes to us. It sort of relativizes human approaches to God. I was thinking that maybe that was vague last night, and so I came up with a metaphor. For profound personal and interpersonal experiences, you don't use relativizing languages. You don't say to your partner or lover, just now I'm having one of several powerful feelings of attraction to you as a person. I mean, that's not something that you'd say to your lover. Just now I'm having one of several profound feelings of attraction to you as a person. What you say is, I love you, you know? Or you don't say anything at all. Because, in fact, even to use language in some sense relativizes the experience. It suggests that the power of what's going on inside of you can actually be conveyed by words. You don't say, I had a profound religious experience this morning around the sunrise. You say something more like, God touched me with the fingers of her dawning this day, and a well of fears and longings gradually dissipated before that like light, like the morning dew. You know, you're looking for something that says this experience is truly unique. What happened to me, you don't even say this experience, you say what happened to me is truly unique, because you don't want it to like dissipate the power of what happened by using words that suggest it's just another of several experiences. And I guess you see what's happening. I'm becoming more poetic as I try to get at these experiences. Poetic language properly frames powerful experience in a way that scientific or prosaic language cannot. poetic language is more effort, it's more unique and individual, and somehow we believe, it feels to us when we use poetic language that we're getting, we're enshrining or framing the experience in a more appropriate way. Throughout the ages, and especially in the past couple hundred years, those who write thoughtfully about religious experience, about meeting God, have done two things. It's very interesting to see this. The first thing they do is they coin a term for the profound experience, which a term which cannot be picked away at. Usually it's a creative new term. A guy named Rudolf Otto in The Idea of the Holy, book about 50 years old, uses a word, the numinous. I don't have that up here, but it kind of means unnameable. It's N-U-M-I-N-O-U-S. William James in the Varieties of Religious Experience uses a lot of words around mystical. But you could also use mystery. If you capitalize it and put it in quotes, the mystery at the center of all things. Or Luther used the holy other to describe this, the way that God is beyond words. So you coin this word, the holy other, and then you say, this is the, what Proudfoot calls it, is a placeholder, or this is the word which is at the beginning. This is the word beyond which we cannot attempt to explain anymore, define anymore, the unnameable. I would say that the wilderness takes the same place. And if you have a profound enough concept of it, I think God also, we can't do more than approach this word with metaphors and poetic language. You simply cannot explain it anymore. So that's the first thing that these people do, is that they postulate this word which is going to stand for the ultimate thing. And then the second thing they do is, as I was talking about before, they lean on poetic, evocative language. And what they attempt to do is evoke in the reader, or if they're a preacher or someone like that, they try to evoke in the listener experiences through evocative language which might parallel their own. So what I was doing a second ago, God touched me with the fingers of her dawning this day. You get this fingers on you, touching you. The fingers of her dawning, it's a her, so it's a different, it throws you into a different sense of God. Her dawning this day, and a well of fears, well is a deep dark thing, a well of fears and longings gradually dissipated before that light like morning dew. It's an attempt to evoke in you an experience which is somewhat parallel to mine, which is much different from me saying to you, I had a profound religious experience this morning around sunrise. See what I mean? So that's how people tend to work with religious experiences, using language and using a placeholder or a word that is no longer no longer defined. I found a quote from Annie Dillard, which is she's trying to do the same thing. Just listen to how she does it. It's about creation. The extravagant gesture is the very stuff of creation. After the one extravagant gesture of creation in the first place, the universe has continued to deal exclusively in extravagances, flinging intricacies and colossi down eons of emptiness, heaping profusions on profligacies with ever fresh vigor. The whole show has been on fire from the word go. You know, attempt to talk about creation in a way that evokes in our own minds what she's trying to get at is extravagance, the richness, the beauty of creation, poetic language. So you might be coming to see that what a lot of people do together to deal with religious experiences or to attempt to understand God in their lives is to try out models and hunches drawing on traditions or past experiences and using a new kind of language with some kind of a placeholder, God or a sense of the ultimate or the wilderness or the other, which is totally outside there. And sometimes it works. And when it works, profound communication is established. What I feel or experience about God comes across to you. And it sometimes becomes memorable and becomes part of our tradition. The Bible is an example of that. I mean, this is stuff about experiencing God, which in our tradition, at least, has been authoritative. People have sensed by the language, by the things that are talked about, by the, you know, the Jews don't even use the word Yahweh because the term Yahweh, that would work for them up there as a placeholder, is too profound. It's too holy to use. So whenever they come across in the Hebrew text the letters YHWH, which means Yahweh, they have, Jews have translated as the Lord. They never translate it as Yahweh. For them, this whole book is full, and for us, this whole book is full of that kind of authority, the language and the experience of God. Preaching uses a kind of language. I'm doing some preaching even right now. You can tell I get excited. I get moved by what I'm talking about. And I'm trying to evoke in you a similar feeling. Using language, attempting to inspire in you or to help you to recognize times when you felt similar things and to give language to those kinds of things and to create a space where you can feel comfortable about expressing your own experiences. In a sense, preaching is a using of language, a using of concepts which is attempting to model for the whole community how to deal with this idea of God. Because, you know, if somebody doesn't do it, we all lose the sense that it can even be done. I notice when I sit down to lunch with people and I say, "Do you want to pray?" They always want to pray, but they never want to do it themselves. And for me, praying is not hard. And so I do the prayer. What happens every time is that by using that language, I get transported into a new space. I don't expect it to happen, and it happens every time. And the other person does as well. It's almost as if God was there, but we just hadn't recognized it. And when we pray, thanking God for the food, for the day, for our friendship, for the beauty of the day, suddenly a new vein of experience is entered. A new kind of experiencing of our lives is entered. We move away from this end of the chart and we move over into that end of it by use of language, a mediation technique. I think part of the problem with modern people is that they've seen manipulations along this line. We see manipulative preachers. We've all had experiences of people in a preacher role being either not in touch with reality in some sense, or just boring or whatever, and we feel violated. I don't know if you've ever felt that, but around the issue of religious experience, there's a great deal of vulnerability, you know? It's very close to our hearts, and if somebody mucks around in there, I really do feel, if they don't use the, if they don't have a profound enough respect, maybe I'm like, maybe this is just my problem, but I sometimes feel like it's too holy, and that the preacher or the religious community or whatever is misusing the presence of God or the idea of the presence of God. That's another reason, I suppose, why I harp on this thing of standards, because if somebody is talking about God the way TV preachers talk about God, I can't listen to it. I mean, it really hurts. It feels feels like a violation. It feels like it just depresses me when I hear it, because my sense of my openness to God and God's love and presence in the world and the transformation of this world by God's love is too important to me to have other people using the same language in a way that I feel it is alienating. I don't know if that's happened to you, but
can I ask something? yesterday when we came and you had the four things, it's all, to me, all keeps coming back, and I was thinking that last night too, that it was hard to pick a square to be in. But the more we talk, it becomes more apparent to me why it was so hard. And then when you were talking yesterday about not fearing nature, it's, you know, it kind of demands that we know a lot about it, rather than to see an avalanche as good or bad. Mm-hmm. I know what it was. It's that with nature, though, in wilderness, it's easy to pick the square down here because I'm real clear in my own mind about my feelings about it, my experience with it, and what it is and what it demands of me to fit into it.
Mm-hmm.
But then you talk about the TV preacher, last night we talked a little bit about Oral Roberts or whatever, and I think with the God experience here and the other three squares, the problem is it's not as clear as wilderness. One, like you were saying, when we have experienced it, or we doubt that this is a godly experience, or even with the Bible, it's not as clear, and you see someone talking on television, and you're not clear about, is this an experience of God or is it not? Mm-hmm. That's why I think the whole wilderness is like God's always in wilderness. But outside of that, it's not real clear where he's at. I mean, when experiences have God in them and when they don't.
Well, I'd venture to say that if our Western tradition had been more sensitive to wilderness for the past 2,000 years, that we'd have as many sects about wilderness as we have about God, that we would have those who would be sort of working like Dick does to preserve wilderness but also use wilderness. Then you'd have the ecologists who say, take the cities off of the map and give it back to the Native Americans. And you'd have the people who would say, and they would say, God will, in fact, the ghost dance religion, if you know anything about it, is it was started by the Paiutes in the Great Basin, and they said that if they can dance to the Great Spirit, that the Great Spirit will remove the white people from the land. Of course, it didn't work. But that was a profound connection for them to wilderness, and it had stipulations and standards of adequacy. The standard of adequacy for the Paiutes in the 1890s was that the white man had to go. See what I mean? So, in a funny kind of way, the reason that we don't disagree about wilderness is because we haven't sat around for a long time and talked about what our ideas are about wilderness. But I would venture to say that if we had done that for the past 2,000 years, we'd have, some of you, they just did an ethics thing in this PLU class, where someone gets inheritance from a dead relative and they want to build a cabin in the woods. But they also belong to the church, and the pastor comes to them and says, why don't you give the money to the church? And then the other issue that comes up for the ecologically minded is, does it make sense to build more cabins in the wilderness when we're trying to experience wilderness as untainted? So that's a profound struggle that it's not a religious issue because we in America deal with it sort of as a private issue. But in terms of wilderness as a place to experience God or the other, that's a profoundly critical issue, is land use, what you do with the land. And we could line up in real different sides. If I draw a quadrant and we talk about ideas of wilderness, then we'd start to, piece out that way. I'd be probably more of an idealist, Dick would be a realist, some of us would be profound realists, we just got to go out there and cut the timber because it's going to grow back, etc. You know what I mean? I mean, in an interesting kind of way, all of this is very complicated, and I think that there isn't a place where we're safe from the complicatedness. However, I think that the Spirit of God does beckon us and empower us through tradition and community and nature to come to some stands of faith, to places where our faith where God feeds us through God's presence and our faith, so that we aren't just overwhelmed by the problems and the decisions we have to make.
Let me read something that's so directly related to what we're discussing here. And I'll give you the author of these words in the time afterwards to put it into context. At a certain stage of complexity, the human community found expediency yardsticks no longer sufficient. One by one, it has evolved and superimposed upon them a set of ethical yardsticks. The first ethics dealt with the relationship between individuals. Later accretions dealt with the relationship between the individual and society. Christianity tries to integrate the individual to society. Democracy to integrate social organizations to the individual. Key passage. There is as yet no ethic dealing with man's relationship to land and to the non-human animals and plants which grow upon it. Land, like Odysseus' slave girls, is still property. The land relation is still strictly economic, entailing privileges but not obligations. And then skipping ahead, he says, as soon as I find where he says it, well, I really want that right now. Okay, the individual is Aldo Leopold. The time is 19. Think about that. And this reprint, and it was published in the Journal of Forestry, 1933. This reprint is in the Journal of Forestry in 1989. And it is raising the same question, because the question was never answered in 1933, whether the Society of American Foresters should add a land ethic to the canon of ethics for the profession of foresters. And so, you know, we find ourselves in a modern debate of a concept that's really not all that very old, I mean, the length of my lifetime today. And we indeed do not have, either in the profession or in society, a truly developed ethic toward the land. Now later I'm going to read some things much earlier than this that raised the issue. But I find that absolutely amazing, but I also find it a clear definition of two things. One, why Aldo Leopold was a major mover in the development of the wilderness system, which was his response to his own challenge, and why in fact we have find ourselves in a situation where we have abused the environmental gifts that we were given by the Creator, to the point that we now have a major repair job to do. Mm-hmm. But it's an ethical question.
Well, I think I'll just do a quick transition to your from what I was talking about. I may talk later about what. An experiment that is actually very intriguing. Maybe I'll just throw it in here. It's a brief thing. To give you a sense of what's at stake in terms of experience of God, whether there is an unmediated experience of God or not is the question. Do you remember in 1 Samuel when the kid Samuel is in the temple? Does anybody remember that story? What happens? Yeah, how does it go? Do you remember?
It's called three times.
But what's the call? What are the words?
Samuel.
And then what does the kid do?
He goes to see Eli,
who's the priest, right? And he says, "Here I am." And the priest says, "I didn't call you." What's the priest say the third time?
He's asked from the Lord.
Yeah, the priest says, speak, Lord, for your servant hears. So the little boy has learned, you see, that God has spoken to the little boy, but he didn't know it. You see? That's what I'm talking about, mediation. God speaks to us, but we don't know it because we don't know what to look for. When God speaks to Elijah on the mountaintop, Elijah knows what this still small voice is because he knows where he is. He knows that he's just spent 40 days walking. He knows that the food that comes to him isn't just any old food that fell from the sky. It's from an angel. It's from God. You need to have some criteria to be able to know that it's from God and not just indigestion. Well, what's interesting in this experiment here is that a guy named Stanley Schachter, a psychologist, is attempting to understand the origin of emotions. And what he's trying to do is separate physiological arousal, because there's this idea that emotions are really physical things that you immediately identify. Oh, that's anger. Oh, that's pain. Oh, that's love. What he's trying to do is separate the physical arousal from the cognitive appraisal of the emotion. He says that there are two pieces, physiological arousal, cognitive appraisal. And so what he does is he comes up with a theory. His hypothesis is that when the body kicks the adrenaline in, a person looks around to figure out what's going on and then identifies what is arousing them. So if you're in the presence of a sexually attractive partner, you would conclude, I'm really attracted to this person. If when the adrenaline kicks in, you're seeing a tragic film, you would start to cry because you would conclude that you're very sad. Now, the way the experiment went is very interesting. He administered disguised injections of adrenaline, and he informed some subjects about the resulting effects. He misinformed some subjects, and others he left totally ignorant. Now, a confederate of him, the experimenter, was waiting in the room with the subject as the adrenaline was being administered. And this confederate acted euphoric in one case, and euphoric and frivolous, and in the other case acted insulted and angry by what had happened, you know, by the experimenter coming in and out. Now, the subjects who did not expect arousal symptoms tended to experience the emotion portrayed by the confederate. Understand that the confederate was being frivolous and bouncing around. The person who didn't know what was happening inside their body because they had been administered adrenaline experienced the emotion portrayed by the confederate. Those who were told the appropriate effects to expect from the injection were much less likely to share the confederate's mood. Because they already had a satisfactory account of what was happening to them. And in fact, later experiments have shown that arousal created by drugs, physical exercise, or natural hormonal changes, all three of them, can be labeled anything from euphoria, humor, love, sexual attraction, to hunger, anxiety, conflict, anger, menstrual distress. I mean, there's a kind of, there's a way in which, in other words, emotions have a physiological component which then, apparently, we look in our environment to make sense of. Why is it that this is arising within me? And then when we see something out there that might make sense, oh, I didn't get enough sleep last night, or oh, this person is being mean to me, or oh, I'm really attracted to this person, then we identify the emotion as joy or sadness or despair or hope. And you would see also that certain people would have certain things. A depressive person would gradually become more and more would have the tendency to identify many arousals as depressing, you know, and a joyful person the same. It's a very interesting thing because it suggests that people search for plausible causes and environmental clues to which to attribute anomalous bodily feelings. It also suggests very clearly that self needs these mediations in order to understand what's profoundly going on out there. Because in a sense, we are moved by God, but we need to have ready at hand a way of talking about it, or a way of developing our sense or relationship to the emotion that's coming up. If we have a profound religious feeling, or feeling of vulnerability, or longing, or something like that, if there's religious language at hand, if there's a spiritual director at hand, we will be able to understand that stuff with integrity as having a relationship to God. If that isn't at hand, if we cut ourselves off from the mediations, in a sense, we cut ourselves off from reality. We end up simply with there's this wonderful quote that I found by Schillebecks, who's a theologian, who says that spirituality cut off from creation is pure projection. Spirituality cut off from creation is pure projection. That is, it's an emotion which then we project our own ideas on instead of actually receiving from God and from creation a sense of what is real and being able to articulate it in response or in a dynamic relationship with the wilderness, with that which is out there, the created order. I just wanted to put that out there because I think that'll give us also a little bit of a feel of what is at stake in terms of religious experience, that the way we articulate it is a very important aspect of it. There are standards for that which we have learned from society, namely this group or a church that we belong to. We learn standards from our tradition, and we also learn standards from wilderness. And I want to turn it over to Dick now, because wilderness thinking is something that I think is very important for us to be working on this morning before we actually go out there to realize what the development historically has been in America and in the world. I don't know if you know anything about the world. I know a little bit about America, but wilderness is one of those things which will help us to channel our deepest longings and feelings when we know what wilderness is.
Yeah, I'm going to share a little bit of the history of the philosophy of wilderness with you from a couple of quotes that have a terribly interesting juxtaposition in time. But then this has been a little one way, and so I'm going to try to draw some things from you first to find out what you really know about the wilderness movement rather than just tell you. But listen to these words. Briefly, from Thoreau at Walden Pond, the year is 1854, 136 years ago, I think, is that right? That's about two average lifetimes, okay? So focus, 54 is not just a number. About two lifetimes ago, the nation's first hippie said, I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to confront only the essential facts of life and see if I could not learn what it had to teach and not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived. And Thoreau spent 2 years plus some months in a small cabin on Walden Pond, which, by the way, has a solid waste disposal area within 800 yards of it. And there's a great debate going on, and it's Boston's swimming hole. And there's a great debate going on about the future of Walden Pond right now. And Thoreau's essentially seen and conquered as the world's first hippie and a little bit crazy and not a hero. But interesting words. Now I want to take you to exactly the same year. That's the juxtaposition that strikes me. This was, of course, uttered on the east coast of a settled nation and the early development of our society and our democracy. But on the other coast, in 1954, we had the chief of an Indian tribe saying these words. And this is when he was commenting on the desire, this is Chief Seattle, commenting on the desire of the white people of the United States and the white government to buy the land of the Indians. And this is marvelous, and it's in the bookstore, and I would recommend no one leaves Holden without it. But just a few words. This we know, the earth does not belong to the people. The people belong to the earth. This we know, all things are connected, like the blood which unites one family. All things are connected. Whatever befalls the earth befalls the children of the earth. The people did not weave the web of life, but are merely a strand in it. Whatever we do to the web, we do to ourselves. And then skipping forward, he says, the earth is precious to God, and to harm the earth is to heap contempt on its creator. The whites too shall pass. And he has said earlier that he and his red brothers will pass. The whites too shall pass, perhaps sooner than all other tribes. Continue to contaminate your bed, and you will one night suffocate in your own waste. Rather a profound prediction for an individual that described himself as a barbaric person, and probably with more accuracy than we would like to contemplate right now. It's thoughts like that, you know, two lifetimes ago in this country, that began to stir the passions of a great number of individuals, really, that led to a classified, legislated wilderness system in the United States, which now totals 91 million acres. There are some of my contemporaries that feel that that's about it. I would tell you that that's about half of it. I think it's very safe to predict that the wilderness system will be about 180 to 200 million acres when the job is finished from the standpoint of classification. But let me ask you what you know of the more recent history, let's say from after the turn of the century, about the development of the wilderness system and the final achievement of the Legislative Act in 1964 and then all subsequent acts. Who knows who the shakers and makers were, say, in the 1910s? Who carried this forward with the championship of wilderness in the United States? Anybody know?
Teddy Roosevelt.
I'll talk about Teddy Roosevelt in a minute. Teddy Roosevelt was a dichotomy between two great debates going on.
John Muir.
John Muir certainly was one, and he's slightly before 1910. Who else? Well, let me suggest another player that links John Muir, Teddy Roosevelt, was Gifford Pinchot, who, of course, became the first chief. Okay, but Gifford Pinchot championed utilitarian conservation. Okay? Muir championed, and by the way, Muir was very anthropocentric. Many, many of today's preservationists are very, very biocentric, or in terms that the life forms other than humankind are most important. If you really read Muir, you find that he was very much a humanist, as the chief was. Mm-hmm. And so you had a great debate that went on between the Muir school of thought and philosophy and the Gifford Pinchot, and therefore the Forest Service eventually, school of values, that all these gifts that we have in nature, that we find in nature, and it doesn't matter whether minerals or renewable resources like wood, have utilitarian value, and therefore conservation is wise use of these, not plunder and not the concrete that was the pioneer spirit. Muir went much farther than that. Was a real visionary. He said, no, there's a spiritual value that humankind needs to have the wild lands, or certainly a portion of the wild lands, preserved because of the social and spiritual contribution that they make. So there was a debate going on, and Teddy Roosevelt was sort of the referee in all of this, because Teddy Roosevelt was instrumental in responding to both of them. He was a champion of national parks. He stood on the rim of the Grand Canyon. And if you've seen pictures of Teddy Roosevelt's hunting camp in the Yellowstone, and there's 500 dead animals, you'd kind of wonder how much conservationist it really was. But you know, he was a real dichotomy, because he championed the national park system, and he stood on the rim of the Grand Canyon, and he said, this should be preserved as it is because there is nothing we can do to improve it. And at the same time, he used all kinds of political skullduggery to create the National Forest System in an 11th hour, and literally 11 o'clock at night, before an act took effect at midnight that took away his power to transfer lands from the forest reserves into national forests. And so he signed the act, to be effective that midnight, and at 11 o'clock signed dozens of orders that created the National Forest System that we have today in 1905. And so it was, there you go, Congress. And so he was an interesting player. But we go to the 1910s, then who came on the scene? Who were the champions that really said, we need a system? We can't just have this esoterically, we have to have it politically. It has to be protected or we're not trustworthy. We need a law. Who started all that? Environmental group? Wilderness Society? Didn't exist. Sierra Club? It existed, but they didn't start it. Members of the Forest Service? Gifford Pinchot, Arthur Carhart. They gave birth to the wilderness movement. The first wilderness was created in the National Forest administratively. And in fact, when the act passed in 1964, all of the acres of wilderness that became instant wilderness on September 3rd, 1964, about 13 million acres, had been created by the Forest Service administratively. So, I always run into a concept that the Forest Service was forced to accept wilderness. In fact, there were people like Aldo Leopold, John Marshall, incidentally the first president of the Wilderness Society, and helped to form it. And a great many citizens that participated with them as really rebels with the cause. They were not heroes within the Forest Service, make no mistake about it. They were seen as a little bit fruity chasing a non-utilitarian value. And so the wilderness movement got birth despite the Gifford Pinchot value system within the Forest Service, but with a whole lot of help from our friends from the Zonheisers and the Mearys and all of the great names of the wilderness movement. But it's real important to understand that, because it was very necessary within the National Forest System to make the act of preservation, because we were slowly eroding away the options. And the first wilderness in the National Forest System was 1917. We were only 12 years old. And that was a Gila, which is now named after Aldo Leopold appropriately. And so we're still making wilderness in this state. The most recently was 1984. What do you know about it? Okay, we talk about preservation of wilderness, and we are surrounded literally. I drew the latest additional boundary, you know, tight around Holden for the Glacier Peak in 1984. But Glacier Peak was one of the instant wildernesses in 64. I made additions in 66 in the Whitechuck and Sioux when I did the North Cascades one. So we've been adding to the Glacier Peak. But, you know, once you cross that boundary, what changes? What's different? What are your options? What can you do? What can't you do? Anybody know?
No more motorists.
Right.
Trapping.
Yeah, you can camp.
Is hunting restricted within a wilderness area?
No, not in the national forest. Recognize there's wildernesses in the national parks, and there, in those places it is. There are wildernesses in the fish and wildlife refuges, and in those places it is. For the most part. There are a very small amount of wilderness, but there's going to be a very large amount of wilderness in the Bureau of Land Management lands, and hunting will continue there. What else?
Isn't the fire, your fire, putting it, you don't put them out yet. Isn't that part of that changed in 84? I'm a little bit vague on some of the things.
Okay.
But was it like you don't build fire roads like they used to?
The act itself leaves a prerogative to the agency on how we behave relative to fire suppression or any other emergencies that involve life or property. What evolved, though, was a recognition that fire was not bad. It's back to the bads and goods. And when I started in the Forest Service, fire was definitely bad. And one of the wonderful things we did is stomp it out. In fact, we have quickly recognized there's not an ecosystem in North America, save one Arctic island, and we're not sure about that one, that does not have fire in its history. That fire is a functioning part of the ecosystem. And so with that knowledge, we first, in wilderness and the Park Service, began to use a different tactic. But that tactic we now use in and out of wilderness. So it's not clearly a wilderness decision. The option, though, is ours. Congress did not foreclose our actions on fire at all. That's been self, you know, that's been a self-discovery that fires has an appropriate role there. Well, fundamentally what happens, you know, you can't use motorized. Yes, you can have a primitive form of recreation there. It's one of the purposes of wilderness. But wilderness, the wilderness system created a resource, didn't create, it recognized a resource, wilderness. That wilderness is a resource. There are many people, even within the Forest Service that manage wilderness, that tend to think of it as a area dedicated to primitive forms of recreation. In fact, recreation is a tolerated use so long as it is commensurate with the wilderness resource values. And there are parts of the wilderness system you and I cannot enter. How many people are familiar with the Oregon coast and the Hasita Head Lighthouse and that beautiful cove, and you see it on hundreds of calendar arcs? How many people have been there? Yeah. You know the two rocks that are below the lighthouse, and that when you view from the bridge and you see those two prominent rocks? They're part of the wilderness system. And you can't get on them. And they're reserved for bird life, as are many, many other rocks, and they're part of what's called the Oregon Islands Wilderness. They're managed by the Fish and Wildlife Service. The Great Condor portion of the Ventana Wilderness in California has restricted human entry to preserve the habitat of, in that case, a rare and endangered species, mostly rare and endangered, I think, by well-meaning scientists. But anyway, I won't get into that. There are parts you can't enter. So wilderness is fundamentally a piece of land that is classified with wilderness, the resource, the dominant resource value. All other uses are subjugated to that use, or to that value, to that resource. There's no other country in the world that seen fit to take that adventure. I had a former boss, former director of recreation, who was not a great champion of wilderness, he was a great champion of recreation. He saw wilderness as an infringement on recreation choices. And he said, only a country as rich as the United States can afford wilderness. And I would suggest to you that any country that can afford it is automatically poor. And there are countries, the Green Party in Germany and now in, even in Eastern Europe, that is now espousing a wilderness classification. Canada is considering a wilderness classification, maybe too late in parts of British Columbia, but they are now have champions for wilderness resources. That's one of the American exports, other than littering, that we can probably be rather proud of. And so it's, you know, that's where we find ourselves. That the wilderness movement was born in philosophy, was born in the perception of some very visionary individuals. And by the way, they were not all men. And there's a tendency, because of the time, to celebrate the male visionaries of the wilderness movement. But there were a great many women involved in the movement and who were very active. Unfortunately, we're not quite as, Margaret Meary is certainly one of them, but not as well celebrated. In fact, I spent some time trying to find the quotes from them. I suspect they may be more pragmatic and than profound and sharper to the point. But we have, you know, we have given birth and are perpetuating a recognition of really of what Chief Seattle was all about. The other thing I'd share with you is we know that a majority, and we sometimes estimate as much as 70% of the support for wilderness comes from people who have only a vicarious experience with wilderness. They've never been there, and they will never go there. The vast majority, I think about 70% of the people that have supported the wilderness movement actively and politically and fought for the passage of the acts and the subsequent acts, are non-users, non-visitors. That the vicarious experience is important enough to them, whether it's spiritual, intellectual, or comfort, that they provide their support for a very, very expensive, when you consider alternate land uses and values, a very expensive decision and an opportunity cost. So that's really where we find ourselves today, and we can go forever on wilderness philosophy, and philosophy becomes law. But I think it's important that you understand that beyond just it's wilderness because I sense it to be, and that doesn't matter whether it's a park in a city or your own backyard, that there is a real wilderness system. And we made it, and I'm glad we did, and we're still making it. And it is giving nature in predominance over all the other things of and values of humankind. Questions?
What were you saying about backcountry? Last summer you spoke of how the use of backcountry is defined a little differently than wilderness, is more allowed.
Yeah, very briefly, I feel that, and it was a part of the address I made at the 25th anniversary of the Wilderness Conference in Minneapolis this year, and I keynoted, there were three breakout sessions. I keynoted one which dealt with the management of wilderness from the exterior. It's my belief and the belief of a lot of people who worked in the wilderness movement, we need a second category called backcountry where the emphasis would not be on the wilderness resource, would be on primitive forms of recreation where we would allow more social interaction. We actually limit social interaction in wilderness is one of the management things we do. We have concerns with the amount of social interaction that happens just on the trail between here and Lyman. Now the people that are using the trail don't, for the most part, some do. But we have a responsibility to perpetuate and preserve an opportunity for solitude. And so we have a real difficult task when it comes to managing the use of wilderness. But we feel we need an alternate category that would have a higher comfort level, would tolerate much higher social contact, may well have chalets and hostels that were available by hiking and cross-country skiing. But we think it needs to be a system like the wilderness system, and there's a certain movement in the United States right now moving in that direction. As a protective device to be able to maintain the wildernesses that we have them today, as an alternate use area. We're an aging society. People want to be active in the environment because they have a concern about personal health and the environment, but they are aging, they are wealthier, and they'd like to play hard and then stay in some comfort. We're seeing a lot of popularity to the concepts of hut systems, which have been a longtime feature of Europe and in some way the Adirondacks or Appalachians. So that's what backcountry is all about. It's a defense of the wilderness system by an alternate use area where you still wouldn't have logging and roads and so on. Yeah?
More and more people are recognizing wilderness as having intrinsic value in and of itself in terms of intrinsic economic value.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of islands, fresh air, as sources of clean drinking water, as sources of clean water for our fish resources, as a biological pool, if you will, for not only wildlife, but in some cases game species. Things like that, I think more and more people are going to recognize that wilderness isn't an economic waste.
Surely.
They're important to us.
There are several named purposes of wilderness in the Act, and there is no hierarchy of purpose.
Right.
Recreation is the most prominent recognized use because a lot of people do go there for a primitive recreation experience and may or may not have a so-called wilderness experience. But the Act also talks about its scientific value and as a benchmark. Natural area upon which we can record the differences between how nature reacts in a place we manage versus the wilderness in the same ecosystem. So it has a wonderful benchmark value. And of course it has gene pool value for all
I'm
species.
Thinking beyond scientific value, things that people in the cities can see in terms.
Right. And I think that's the root of the people that support it that never go there, frankly.
Yeah.
I'd never thought a lot in all the years I worked in the wilderness movement and in wilderness management about the spiritual value of wilderness particularly. I hadn't thought particularly about it, really until I got involved with Holden. And that began to make me really think about that and then go back in my experiences and realize the fervor and passion of the many people that I'd known that, that quote, fought for wilderness, unquote, what really must be driving them. And it was a spiritual fervor. In all, you know, that may or may not be religious, spiritual. And so I think that's always been, frankly. And the earliest arguments for wilderness were along those lines. The latter-day arguments are to stop something from happening. We don't want that valley logged. We don't want roads in that area. The 84 bill was sharply driven by the desire to stop things, not to include highly deserving areas into wilderness, but the early wilderness movement focused on exactly what you're talking about. Anything else?
We might be able to go from that point into a wider discussion, but the point of wilderness having a value in itself, that is, without climbing Copper Peak, but standing over here and looking at it, it does something. Something happens. There's a way in which it is not itself, which is just a peak, a pile of rocks, but it causes us to be connected with Thoreau, Chief Seattle, with a sense of freedom from self-centeredness or a sense of connection to the universe. It's a wonder, and in fact, you can sit in an office building in Seattle and remember from a year ago or 10 years ago looking at Copper Peak and have the same thing happen. That's one of the marvelous things that we're talking about here in terms of spirituality, that is being in touch with the other or some sense of otherness or some powerful experience in our own hearts, even when we're in an environment which doesn't give us the actual stimuli. It's sort of remembered stimuli or something. I think it's very fascinating. I don't know. We're going to be going out a little bit later this morning, and perhaps we should just be kicking around for each other, helping each other to figure out how that works, how it is that we are rescued from self-centeredness by an intervention almost of the great mystery of the God beyond us all, and nature as well as culture, tradition as well as society playing a mediating role, a sort of midwife role in that. I think we just need to kick around some of our experiences, some hunches that we have about that. Just to sort of prime the pump for, what are you anticipating as you look forward to going out and being alone for an hour in the wilderness?
The beauty is that I'm anticipating nothing.
Seriously. You had said that last night. That's
the beauty to me, is that I anticipate nothing. I simply go.
See something you haven't seen before.
Solitude, just hearing and seeing a lot of things you wouldn't normally experience unless you did take the time. You know, like we are to do them.
Sense of knowing God at the start, to go out and just immerse myself in His creation. It's just, you know, it gets me away from all the distractions that I'm used to living with and puts me more in tune with that I'm just a small part of His whole larger thing, which enables me just to open up more and be more at peace to really listen to Him.
Thank you. the coffee break. Do we want to go to coffee break or just talk for a few moments? Maybe we can go up there in 5 minutes. Let's stay on this for a couple more minutes.
I got the Flannery O'Connor book, yes, and I was looking at it last night, and it ends. Actually, I was going to bring it and read the quote tonight, but I can't quote it very eloquently. The point is, and I think it's a little of what you're saying, and she has such a way with words, but it's from the river. And of course, she always deals with the people from the South, and they have such a way. But it is a man who is walking out into the river, and said he is through going to the Baptist, through the Baptist minister, and he's going to immerse himself, and baptize himself, and he immerses himself in the river. And of course, the way she says it is so wonderful, but I think when I read it, I mean, I think that there is something about going out into the wilderness that does let fall away the need for other mediation. I mean, you really don't need the Baptist minister with you. And that sense of urgency that she portrays when she says that is feels real real to me. And I think that that's, you know, if no matter how you feel when you go, when you go alone, there is a real urgency in letting yourself really be out there alone. That's
sense of direct, direct encounter. Yeah.
I don't know. For me, I'm just looking forward to an hour of silence. I don't think in my normal everyday life, when I get up and turn on the clock radio to wake me up and go to work and come home, that I've ever had an hour of silence in a long time. And I just think that's going to be very nice.
I sincerely hope that you don't find an hour of silence. Let me tell you what I mean. I think what you mean is an hour free of noise. One of the exercises that we did the first wilderness retreat was to listen. It was this particular part of it. And one of the tasks was to listen. Because there is a concept that nature is quiet, and it's particularly quiet with night, and that year 9 feet of snow. In fact, everybody came back when they really contemplated sound that it was not silence. And in fact, there was a lot of interpretation of sound going on among people that had never done it before. So I know exactly what you mean, but it isn't silent out there, folks. And one of the key things, the key word that comes to my mind in this whole exercise of going out and trying to guide yourself into real contemplation of the place you are, your place in it, and then maybe the cares and woes you brought with you, and an examination of those, of how many are legitimate, we'll talk about that later, but is focus. That's the key word for me. It's learning to focus on natural surroundings. And I do that a lot better than I do on urban surroundings. When people ask me, I mean, I was raised in Portland, they ask me what street something's on, I can never tell because I don't pay attention to street signs. I'm telling them how to get there. I don't know what street's on or care. But I focus a great deal on nature. I can tell you where every single clump of hundreds of flowers or individual blooms that I've taken and are in my slide collection are, and I can take you to them. And I may have been there once. And so I've learned to focus because I care what's out there. And that's all you have to do. And when you begin to do that, you'll focus on yourself. You'll focus on your inner self, and it is just a place that helps you do that. And so think about that. Think about really concentrated focus first on these things around you, of which you now become a part. You made yourself a part. And then begin to draw from inside you through focus. You know, what needs to be focused on? And you only know that.
That's very good advice. I'm grateful for that. I think focus, also the idea of you're still in transition, and there are going to be ideas and thoughts coming to you about you know, your clock radio and things like that. I'd say be really gentle with yourself. Don't grow frustrated or try to force yourself to think a certain thing. Dick's ideas are a very good one, to just focus on what's out there. Really focus on the wilderness. Look around and really look at things. Imagine that you were trying to draw it. How would you draw that? You know, or try to get a picture of it. Another exercise they did a couple years ago was two people would go out. One would be the camera and one would be the photographer, and the camera would keep her eyes closed, and then the photographer would say, "Look," and squeeze their hand, and then
actually, it was the earlobe. We'd pull the earlobe. It was wild. Anybody that saw us would lock the whole bunch up. But it was unbelievable, because I'd been doing photography in the same place up in the ball yard that morning. And I think I'm very perceptive, and particularly because of photography. And I had an old gentleman with me. I wish I remembered him. Wonderful guy, about 80 years old. And I was the camera and he was a photographer in the first drill, and I thought this was all kind of funky. And I had an anticipation of what I was going to see when he pulled my earlobe, and the whole exercise is to blink your eyes. And what happens is exactly what happens in a camera. Your eyes have the lens of a camera is patterned exactly after your eye. It's an optic. And so you record. You record on the film of your mind, your memory, the scene. And so for an instant, and I was all set for a grand landscape, which is what I've been shooting that morning, and I was 2 inches away from a rime ice covered branch that had two little conelets on it, and it was there for that split second, and it recorded itself, you know, just exactly as it does on film. And then we went through a whole series of these, and I never once was able as the camera to anticipate the scene I was going to have. And I can still see it. I can still record it. I could draw it for you, because I'm an artist. And so it was really a marvelous exercise, and I don't care how perceptive you think you are, it made you recognize that you're not as focused as you think. And it also told you something about the person that was the photographer. I learned a great deal about, and the old gentleman and I had a lot of conversation before that. I learned more about him when he was being my photographer, and I was being his camera, by those things of nature that were of value to him. That's what he was showing me. Those things that caught his attention now are mine. It's interesting. You might try it. It's pretty clumsy in cross-country skis, a lot of you. but it's an interesting exercise. Sure hard on your earlobe, though.
So when you, a couple of pieces of advice, take an sled pad. When you get to a place where you want to be, keep your skis on and just step down the snow, so that when you lay your pad out, the snow is already packed down. So you have a large platform, and then just sit yourself down. Take some extra clothing with you, because getting there will heat you up, and then sitting there for an hour, if you decide to stay in one place for a whole hour, will cool you down. So you might want to take a backpack with you. There are a couple of places that spring to mind as possibilities. The ball field is straight up the road here. Where the road goes around across the bridge, there's a trail that goes straight up, and it's another quarter mile, I guess. There's a loop that follows across the bridge as you go up here. You go across the bridge to the other side of the creek on the vehicle path, and you go all the way up to the garage, and then you continue in this direction down the valley, and you'll find a ski path there, which takes you on top of the tailings, and it's a loop that goes around. And actually, sitting on top of the tailings would really be a wonderful place to be as well, because it's even more wide open in some sense than the ball field is, and you can look, if it's clear, you can see sometimes all the way down to...
All Jeff's doing is displaying his bias. that's mine too. I'm attracted to a spacious place and a long distance view, but you may not be.
Yeah.
Recognize the closeness to Railroad Creek itself and the sound may be more important to you. So, you know, mm-hmm. I don't think anybody can advise you on where your special place is, but